Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the show, we have stories from Brian Lynn and Kelly Jean Kelly. Later, Alice Bryant brings us Ask a Teacher. And we close the show with The American Story, Two Thanksgiving Day Gentlemen by O. Henry. But first, American reporter Marie Colvin told important stories about the suffering of civilians in war. Starting in the late 1980s, Colvin traveled to some of the most dangerous and horrifying conflicts in the world. She reported on the people she met and their experiences. Parents whose children were killed or missing. Children silenced by trauma. Victims of rape and other atrocities. Right now, several media projects explore Colvin's life. Matthew Heineman's movie, A Private War, is based on a story published in Vanity Fair magazine following the reporter's death in Syria in 2012. Actor Rosamund Pike plays the fierce reporter who gave her life while reporting on conflicts around the world.
In war zones, parents go to bed at night, not knowing if their children will see the morning. That is a measure of fear that I can never feel.
While her fear might not have been as deep, the movie shows that Colvin clearly suffered as a result of her work. She lost her eye in 2001 when Sri Lankan forces attacked in a rebel-held area. The black cloth eye cover she wore became a sign of her bravery. But the movie suggests Marie Colvin's mental pain was far worse. She most surely was a victim of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Pike, playing Colvin, tells a friend about her relationship to alcohol.
I'm most happy with a vodka martini in my hand, but I can't stand the fact that the chatter in my head won't go quiet until there's a quart of vodka inside me.
That is a main message expressed in A Private War. The mind continues to battle long after the person has left the war zone. Colvin had terrible hallucinations for years. Often she would see the bloodied body of a young girl lying on Colvin's own bed. Rosamund Pike said understanding how Colvin moved was important in portraying her.
I had to learn to smoke, you know, convincingly, because she, you know, for Marie, everything was better with a cigarette. Every conversation, every car drive. I had to see the way she gestured with her hands. She had these wide apart fingers. I had to work out how the eye patch made her angle her head differently.
As a producer of documentaries, Heineman wanted to give this film a real-life feeling. In a scene of the discovery of a mass burial place in Iraq, Heineman used real victims of war to play mourners.
And, you know, at the end of that scene, like in any documentary that I made, you know, something unforeseen happened. They started chanting and doing this prayer for the dead.
Rosamund Pike says she had a similar experience while filming an unwritten scene with a refugee woman. It is set in a safe house in 2012 during a Syrian government operation that was part of the 3-year offensive against the city of Homs. The woman tells how she feeds her baby only sugar and water. She says her body stopped producing milk after the suffering of losing one of her children to a bomb attack.
The woman said to me, she said, please, I don't want this just to be words on paper. I want the world to know that a generation is dying here. I want this, the world to know my story.
Pike says at that time, she felt what drove Colvin, the reporter's responsibility to serve as a witness to people's suffering. Filmmaker Heineman looks at the complexity of Colvin's personality, her bravery, and drive to get war reports out. He shows how she stood her ground in Homs, even during the heavy shelling of the city by Syrian forces.
Let me go.
Hey, we will freaking die if we go back.
She felt compelled to tell the story, to tell the story of a group of 28,000, you know, civilians in Homs who were besieged. And she felt, as she often did, if I don't do this, then who will?
And that story of the inhumanity she witnessed in Homs was her last. Marie Colvin was killed there in a government shelling attack in 2012.
Swiss citizens will vote Sunday on an issue involving cows that has divided the country. Voters will decide if farmers can receive government aid for not removing the horns of their cows. Cows are an important part of the nation's milk industry. They are also a national symbol for Switzerland and draw visitors to the country. Farmer Armin Kapaul began the effort to keep horns on cows 9 years ago. Kapaul told Reuters that listening to his cows incited him to act. When his campaign to persuade politicians failed, Kapaul collected more than 100,000 signatures to hold a national vote on the issue. He is seeking to have the government give farmers yearly payments of about $200 for each horned cow they have. Kapaul says the money is needed to help farmers pay for extra costs linked to keeping horned animals. Having more space for the animals helps prevent fights and injuries involving cow horns. Kapaul hopes the government assistance will reduce the number of dehorned cows. Kapaul says horns help cows communicate and keep the right body temperature. We must respect cows as they are, he told Reuters on his small farm in northwestern Switzerland. Leave them their horns. When you look at them, they always hold their head high and are proud. When you remove the horns, they are sad, he said. About 75% of Swiss cows are dehorned or genetically hornless. Kapaul's plan would require a change to the Swiss constitution. The government opposes the idea. It estimates the assistance would represent about $30 million a year of the country's agriculture budget. Many farmers have also expressed concerns about how the country would pay for the proposed assistance. Groups opposed to dehorning have supported Kapaul's campaign. Dehorning involves burning a young cow's small horns with a hot iron. Farmer Stefan Gilgen has 48 cows that provide about 260 gallons of milk a day. He told Reuters that his cows get along better without horns. If cows have horns, the danger of injuries to the animals and humans is greater, he said. Gilgan added that he does not agree that a vote should be taken to change the Constitution for such an issue. Each farm should decide for itself. We have other problems in agriculture, he said. The latest public opinion studies have suggested Sunday's vote will be very close. I'm Brian Lynn.
For almost 200 years, the House of Representatives, part of the United States Congress, has barred lawmakers from wearing hats. But this year, voters in Minnesota elected Ilhan Omar to represent them in the House. Omar, who was born in Somalia and is Muslim, wears a scarf that covers her head. In answer, some political leaders are calling for a change to the rules so that lawmakers can wear religious headwear during official meetings. The proposed change would enable Omar to wear a headscarf on the House floor. It would also permit lawmakers to wear other kinds of religious headwear, such as kippahs. But it is unclear whether any current lawmaker would do so. The reason for the ban on hats is mostly related to ideas about respectful behavior. Currently, the rule appears alongside bans on smoking or using small computers, such as iPhones, while lawmakers are meeting publicly. But Democratic Party lawmakers have suggested a proposal to permit religious headwear. Nancy Pelosi and Jim McGovern were two of the writers of the proposal. They noted to NBC News that this year, voters had elected the most diverse Congress in history. McGovern added, the amended headwear rule would permit lawmakers to do their jobs, regardless of their religious beliefs. The Washington Post newspaper notes that the headwear proposal also denounces some of the anti-Muslim language heard in several election campaigns. The Post added, it is also notable, coming at a time when several U.S. allies in Europe are adopting countrywide bans on face veils. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Here at VOA, I am a teacher. But outside of work, I am a language learner too. Having studied three languages, I know that sometimes the simplest words can be the most elusive. Today, our question comes from a reader named Valentina. Here it is.
Hello. I would like to know when to use well or good.
Hi, Valentina. I hope you're doing well. Today is a good day to learn English. I wonder if you followed how I used the words well and good. In the first sentence, well describes the verb doing. In the second, good describes the noun day. Well is an adverb. Like many adverbs, well describes the way that something is done. Well answers the question, how? Good is an adjective. We use it to describe nouns. So, we can say Valentina is a good singer. We used good to describe the singer. And we can say Valentina sings well. We used well to describe how Valentina sings. This sounds simple, right? But there are a few rules that do not follow this formula. Rule number one, use good for the five senses: sight, taste, smell, touch, and sound. Listen to a few examples.
The holiday meal tasted so good.
What is that perfume? It smells good.
This bed feels good. It is so soft.
Sense verbs are linking verbs. We use good with other linking verbs, such as seem and appear. Rule number two, to talk about physical health, use well. Let's hear examples.
I do not feel well. I think I should see a doctor.
You don't look well. How are you feeling?
Rule number three, to talk about an emotional state, use good.
I felt good when I finally completed the program.
He feels good about helping his mother.
So, how do you answer the common question, how are you? In American spoken English, we usually answer, I'm good, or just good. But if you would like to be a little more formal, you can say, I'm well, or I'm doing well. Lastly, the comparative and superlative words for well and good are better and best. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Alice Bryant.
Two Thanksgiving Day Gentlemen. There is one day that is ours. There is one day when all Americans go back to the old home and eat a big dinner. Bless the day. The president gives it to us every year. Sometimes he talks about the people who had the first Thanksgiving. They were the Puritans. They were some people who landed on our Atlantic shore. We really don't remember much about them. But those people ate a large bird called turkey on the first Thanksgiving day. So we have turkey for Thanksgiving dinner, if we have enough money to buy a turkey. That is a tradition. Yes, Thanksgiving Day is the one day of the year that is purely American. And now here's the story to prove to you that we have old traditions in this new country. They are growing older more quickly than traditions in old countries. That is because we are so young and full of life. We do everything quickly. Stuffy Pete sat down on a seat in the New York City park named Union Square. It was the third seat to the right as you enter Union Square from the east. Every Thanksgiving Day for 9 years, he had sat down there at 1 in the afternoon. Every time, things had happened to him. They were wonderful things. They made his heart feel full of joy. And they filled another part of him, too. They filled the part below his heart. On those other Thanksgiving Days, he had been hungry. It is a strange thing. There are rich people who wish to help the poor, but many of them seem to think that the poor are hungry only on Thanksgiving Day. But today, Pete was not hungry. He had come from a dinner so big that he had almost no power to move. His light green eyes looked out from a gray face on which there was still a little food. His breath was short. His body had suddenly become too big for his clothes. It seemed ready to break out of them. They were torn. You could see his skin through a hole in the front of his shirt. But the cold wind with snow in it felt pleasantly cool to him. for Stuffy Pete was overheated with the warmth of all he had had to eat. The dinner had been much too big. It seemed to him that his dinner had included all the turkey and all the other food in the whole world. So he sat, very, very full. He looked out at the world without interest, as if it could never offer him anything more. The dinner had not been expected. He had been passing a large house near the beginning of that great broad street called Fifth Avenue. It was the home of two ladies of an old family. These two old ladies had a deep love of traditions. There were certain things they always did. On Thanksgiving Day at noon, they always sent a servant to stand at the door. There he waited for the first hungry person to walk by. The servant had orders to bring that person into the house and feed him until he could eat no more. Stuffy Pete happened to pass by on his way to the park. The servant had gathered him in. Tradition had been followed. Stuffy Pete sat in the park looking straight before him for 10 minutes. Then he felt a desire to look in another direction. With a very great effort, he moved his head slowly to the left. Then his eyes grew wider and his breath stopped. His feet in their torn shoes at the ends of his short legs moved about on the ground. For the old gentleman was coming across Fourth Avenue toward Stuffy's seat. Every Thanksgiving for 9 years, the old gentleman had come there to find Stuffy Pete on his seat. That was a thing that the old gentleman was trying to make into a tradition. Every Thanksgiving Day for 9 years, he had found Stuffy there. Then he had led Stuffy to a restaurant and watched him eat a big dinner. They do these things more easily in old countries like England. They do them without thinking about them. But in this young country, we must think about them. In order to build a tradition, we must do the same thing again and again for a long time. The old gentleman loved his country. He believed he was helping to build a great American tradition. And he had been doing very well. 9 years is a long time here. The old gentleman moved straight and proud toward the tradition that he was building. Truly, feeding Stuffy Pete once a year was not a very important tradition. There are greater and more important traditions in England. But it was a beginning. It proved that a tradition was at least possible in America. The old gentleman was thin and tall and 60. He was dressed all in black. He wore eyeglasses. His hair was whiter and thinner than it had been last year. His legs did not seem as strong as they had seemed the year before. As this kind old gentleman came toward him, Stuffy began to shake and his breath was shorter. He wished he could fly away, but he could not move from his seat. "Good morning," said the old gentleman. "I am glad to see that the troubles of another year have not hurt you. You continue to move in health about the beautiful world. For that blessing you and I can give thanks on this day of Thanksgiving. If you will come with me, my man, I will give you a dinner that will surely make your body feel as thankful as your mind." That is what the old gentleman said every time, every Thanksgiving Day, for 9 years. The words themselves were almost a tradition. Always before, they had been music in Stuffy's ear. But now he looked up at the old gentleman's face with tears of suffering in his eyes. The snow turned quickly to water when it fell upon his hot face. But the old gentleman was shaking with the cold. He turned away with his back to the wind, and he did not see Stuffy's eyes. Stuffy had always wondered why the old gentleman seemed sad as he spoke. He did not know that it was because the old gentleman was wishing that he had a son. A son would come there after he himself was gone. A son would stand proud and strong before Stuffy and say, "In remembrance of my father." Then it would really be a tradition. But the old gentleman had no family. He lived in a room in one of the old houses near the park. In the winter, he grew a few flowers there. In the spring, he walked on Fifth Avenue. In the summer, he lived in a farmhouse in the hills outside New York. And he talked of a strange bug he hoped someday to find. In the fall season, he gave Stuffy a dinner. These were the things that filled the old gentleman's life. Stuffy Pete looked up at him for half a minute, helpless and very sorry for himself. The old gentleman's eyes were bright with the giving pleasure. His face was getting older every year, but his clothes were very clean and fresh. And then Stuffy made a strange noise. He was trying to speak, as the old gentleman had heard the noise 9 times before. He understood it. He knew that Stuffy was accepting.
"Thank you. I'm very hungry."
Stuffy was very full. But he understood that he was part of a tradition. His desire for food on Thanksgiving Day was not his own. It belonged to this kind old gentleman. True, America is free, but there are some things that must be done. The old gentleman led Stuffy to the restaurant and to the same table where they had always gone. They were known there.
"Here comes that old man," said a waiter. "It buys the old no good fella a dinner every Thanksgiving."
The old gentleman sat at the table watching. The waiters brought food and more food, and Stuffy began to eat. No great and famous soldier ever battled more strongly against an enemy. The turkey and all the other food were gone almost as quickly as they appeared. Stuffy saw the look of happiness on the old gentleman's face. He continued to eat in order to keep it there. In an hour, the battle was finished.
"Thank you," Stuffy said. "Thank you for my Thanksgiving dinner."
Then he stood up heavily and started to go to the wrong door. A waiter turned him in the right direction. The old gentleman carefully counted out $1.30 and left 15 cents more for the waiter. They said goodbye, as they did each year, at the door. The old gentleman went south, and Stuffy went north. Stuffy went around the first corner and stood for 1 minute. Then he fell. There he was found. He was picked up and taken to a hospital. They put him on a bed and began to try to discover what strange sickness had made him fall. And an hour later, the old gentleman was brought to the same hospital. And they put him on another bed and began to try to discover what his sickness could be. After a little time, one of the doctors met another doctor, and they talked. "That nice old gentleman over there," he said, "do you know what's wrong with him? He's almost dead for the need of food. A very proud old man, I think. He told me he has had nothing to eat for 3 days.
And that's our show for today. From VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.